us our rights. We have always had these rights. And if we sit here and continue to discuss the pros and the cons of the Alaska Native Land Claims Settlement Act, the pros and the cons of the IRA, all of those are placing our sovereignty, our self-determination rights under a trustee-trustor relationship. What we have in the Alaska Native Land Claims Settlement Act is not any type of a settlement for the natives, so to speak, but a settlement, without being redundant, to British Petroleum or ARCO or Sohio or Anaconda Copper or any of these other foreign state enterprises that wish to make a profit on the resources of the state of Alaska. What we have is the people of Alaska. The Alaska Native Land Claims Settlement Act justifies third-party trespass actions. Our resources, our life blood, our future that is ours, rightfully ours, is offsetting the national debt of other nations of the world. The east-west debt structure is now a north-south debt structure. We're being placed under another legal system. And if we allow the Alaska Native Land Claims Settlement Act to continue and just sit here and discuss all of the goods and the bads about it, what will happen is through acquiescence, our native common law will then change. We will then be subject. It will be our law, and we are giving away what is rightfully ours. And I think that it seems to be somewhat of it's a detriment to the people, to us, to continually try and make something work that wasn't designed to work for the benefit of the native peoples from the start. So I would hope that people, it seems we're now being more and more educated. We understand now, 12, 13 years later from when the act was passed, We are now discussing the things that we wish to see happen aren't happening, and they won't happen because they were not designed to happen. And the people that supposedly went to Washington, D.C. and represented me, I didn't vote for them. My mother didn't vote for them. My grandmother didn't vote for anyone to go and represent and come out with a bilateral agreement, which is what we don't have. We have a unilateral agreement. And the people that did supposedly represent us, I don't believe that they really understood all of the legal ramifications of what we are now living under. And I would hope that we, the people here, would take a different look, maybe a look at these meetings and what we have under a different light, and understand that we won't have sovereignty and we won't have self-determination under what we have now. It is not possible. Thank you.
Ms. Zillis.
Thank you. My name is Bernita Zillis. I'm a Kachatag Inupiaq from Unalakleet. First, at the very outset, let me take the moment to agree to disagree with the person who just spoke and to say that meetings of this kind, I feel, are necessary. They are not detrimental. We have to get it. This whole issue of Native identity out into the open, because it's been in the closet for too long. I'll give you a good example of this. February 8th of last year, Senator Stevens spoke to a joint meeting of the legislature. And at that meeting, he broke away from his prepared talk to say, oh, by the way, for those natives who think that they're going to be dealing directly, they should think again, because they're going to deal with the state first. He chose, I think, that particular manner in which to address the issue of tribal sovereignty very strategically and tactically. to say, look, this issue of tribal sovereignty is not something that deserves a policy statement issued from my office. Let's give it instead something that is a by-the-way addition to prepared remarks. And he implied, to me anyway, in doing that the issue of tribal sovereignty belonged in the backs of the minds of us, of everyone. And it doesn't. It's an issue that has been a long time coming, and it's being born. A lot of pain. It's going to go on. To me, that whole issue, I consider it deep in muddy waters. I don't know that much about it. Things like that I'm going to leave to my brother. And that's what I have to say just at the beginning. To go on to the subject of this particular conference, Judge Berger asked, is that Berger or Berger? Berger, thank you. Judge Berger asked us to consider ANCSA and any flaws that we could see. I'm not a board member of any corporation. I do volunteer my time and services for various organizations, but I'm speaking as an Alaska Native who is concerned for my children and for myself and for my family. And as an extension of that, my community, my region, the people who belong to the state of Alaska, and then the people all over the world that we'll be hearing from later on within this conference, indigenous people, people who live with the land. The impact of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, I feel, is something that we can never erase. It is written now into our history, and there is no way that we can ignore ANCSA, ever. One of the impacts that we have had as a result of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act has been on the education of Native children. With the advent of ANCSA, the emphasis shifted from subsistence survival to economic and political survival. ANCSA made it a requirement that we place an added emphasis on a working knowledge of the English language so that we could wage effective war in the courts against established masters of the uses of the English language. This emphasis on a knowledge of English was accompanied by a perhaps unintentional de-emphasis on the value of the native tongue. At ANCSA's advent, parents were faced with the blank page of the future, and they were forced to make choices as to what they should impress upon their children as priority life tools. And many of these parents, including my own, seeing the wave of progress, so-called progress, that was sweeping our land in the 50s and the 60s, chose education in the Western way, in the Western tongue. Others chose to press on with the subsistence way of life. Considering the working knowledge of Inupiaq ways of survival and the Inupiaq tongue, Tlingit, Athabaskan, Tsimshian, Aleut, and they pressed on with that. Now our young people are suffering, and the old are suffering, lack of ability to communicate with each other. When I was growing up and acquiring a certain proficiency in the English language, and as I became older and as the realization began dawning on me, At first I thought I should be learning Inupiaq because I considered it was important to me to learn in order for me to speak effectively to my elders. Now I realize the importance, yes, is on communication, but in the other direction, because my elders have so much to teach me, and they're unable to communicate with me because they're more proficient in Inupiaq and I'm more proficient in English. When this happened, this division of the people just in language, this aspect, there came a kind of a myth that arose out of it in the people that we met who were non-native, because they met those of us who could articulate and they thought, now there's a smart native. And they encountered natives who could not articulate because they'd chosen the other way, and they thought because they couldn't articulate in English that they had nothing to say. Articulation doesn't mean anything. It doesn't mean anything. There are people at home who chose not to, who stay, who don't attend the meetings, who don't read the newspapers. They live the Inupiaq way of life, but that doesn't mean that they have nothing to say. They live what they have to say. So many times in gatherings such as this, there's the temptation for those of us who can use English to put on the public face and to speak only to the white people that are present. I want to speak today to the natives that are present. The white people that are present can be interested bystanders if they want to. I am speaking to the natives. When we complain about a lack of franchise on part of the people who carried through ANCSA, who brought it into being, we're not putting down the people that did it. We're not accusing them of bad intentions. I'm sure that they were serving the highest of their intentions, and no, I would not call them tools of anybody. But they did have the lack of franchise to a certain extent. I see that in remarks by my own father, who after ANCSA was enacted said, you know, I never signed a deed. I never had a check addressed to me saying, Stan, we've bought your land, here's your money. That's what we mean by the lack of franchise. That's what I mean by the lack of franchise, and accusatory. I would caution that whatever steps are taken to ameliorate what's been going on, that the next time you start acting and amending, that you obtain a franchise, obtain as far as possible the input from our people. ANCSA brought and emphasized and strengthened the Western concept of land ownership. Whereas in the Inupiaq and other native cultures, that concept was alien to us. Remember the chief in Washington State or Oregon State who asked a very valid, a very great, a very true question about a treaty that was established down there. And he said, how is it possible to own a river? or grass under your feet? How is it possible, by extension, to own the animals and the resources? It's possible only if your whole idea of yourself is based not on the land, but on cash, on a cash economy. And that's what happened with the advent of Ahimsa. It's possible in the cash economy to buy fish and sell fish, to buy the resources and sell the resources. That's something that I find hard to forgive about Ahimsa, that it strengthened that whole ingress of the Western way of life into our way of life. Another thing that Ahimsa did was that in order to compete in this new world, a world that was peopled by corporate entities who were masters of the game again, I use that word again, the old game of money, that we were babies at it, and we got taken quickly, savagely, by these masters. And our own people, in the best of interest, many of them, striving to compete in this world, had to acquire a savvy to enable them to reach the board of directors, to reach the administration positions within the corporations. And in so doing, had to abandon the very thing, the very nativeness of them that made them want to help in the first place. They weren't the same people once they reached those corporate heights. And it showed. It showed pitifully. Because we were taken not just by outsiders, we were taken by our own people. Corporate figures do not answer the need for which Ahimsa was supposedly enacted. The need to protect and maintain and uphold our identity as natives, to help us keep our foothold on the land. David Case had asked the question, how can natives own land and stock as individuals and promote cultural values as whole communities? And I agree with Lily. It struck me as soon as he said it. I wrote his question down to make sure I'd gotten it right. It's backwards. Within the native tradition, the material things are shared, but the cultural spirit is imbued into our children by us as individual parents, aunts, uncles, grandparents, brothers, sisters. Not to be totally negative, I can't sit here and pardoning your caution not to use obscenity, I can't sit here and bitch at you and not say that I don't have any solutions or recommendations. I do. Remove or cancel the clause that divides our people. Ahimsa was never meant to legalize division of families, and yet that will be its effect if that afterborn clause is not revoked. I am the woman that Lily spoke of. I have a son who was born May 5th, 1970. I have a daughter who was born February 10th, 1980. My son is a stockholder in Cook Inlet region. My daughter is disenfranchised. We can't allow this to keep on. Do something about it. Byron Malott said, you can't work on a running machine. Doctors do it all the time when they perform surgery. The thing to do is to maintain the integrity, the good parts of ANCSA, while removing the bad parts. Separate the ownership of the land from corporate identity so that it will be possible for people who want to do so to divorce themselves from the alien cash economy and yet retain their right to use the land as their forefathers did. Don't tie the land to the cash. Separate it anyhow, anyway. Instead of always emphasizing education as one way, native to Western, where our natives are taught to be Western, begin to educate Western people to our ways. You know, I've never seen terror more real than on the faces of white people when they talk to somebody who knows how to talk back. People who have grown up believing in that menagerie concept, whatever it is, that we're animals living off the land. They pay more attention and more concern and consideration to the rangeland, the amount of rangeland, so many square miles needed for a black bear in Yellowstone National Park, than they do to how much land the average native family needs in order to live off the land. And then they confuse us with the black bear, if they even think about it. I've had people look at me, and it's terror that I see on their faces when they realize that they have committed a grievous error in assuming that we do not think, that we do not plan, that we do not feel. I would again ask that you urge our leaders who will be working on ANCSA to establish a franchise, a recognizable franchise, not an unofficial one, not an informal one. Whether they achieve that through the old way of our trusting in our elders, or whether they achieve that through the Western democratic way of voting, establish the franchise. And lastly, finally, our laws were first subverted and then replaced by Western law, and this whole thing was strengthened through ANCSA. Later on in this conference, Doug Sanders and Tim Coulter and others will be speaking about law. And I will tell you what I told them in October of 82. When we were told that the basic deprivation that indigenous peoples all over the world had suffered had been our land being taken from us. And I thought about it, and it didn't jive. And I told them, and I still believe it, that the most basic deprivation that we have suffered as indigenous peoples has been our right to our own laws, our own courts. I illustrate this, as I illustrated it then, that had we been able to fight for our land in our own courts, with our own laws, we wouldn't be sitting here right now. And I told them then, and I will tell you now. When the dog is serving dinner, he does not give himself the bone. Use the IRA clause to restore our right to our own laws. I'd like to thank Justice Berger for the opportunity to speak. I'd like to thank the people that have spoken already. I've been lamenting the fact that I can't stay for the whole thing, but I want to wish everyone that is participating the very most optimum conditions for continuing what you've begun, and I thank you.
Thank you. I think that Mr. Upixen, if you have something further, we'll ask you now.
Yes, Your Honor. The advent of ANCSA brought in the concept of corporation. It was something new, even to our corporate secretary. He had to learn about proxy statements, cumulative voting, and this was something new to the 12 regions. I'd like to get back to knowing what Alaska State was when I was first born. That was 52 years ago, and that's over half a century. All I knew was that it was federal government by virtue of military, Bureau of Indian Affairs, and all of the federal employees that fall under the territorial government then. It had been government, both federal, until it became a state, and even then it was still a state government. So all we've known is government, government, and more government. Until we ran up into the corporate concept. It took Arctic Slope Regional Corporation 4 seminars to hold Village Corporation Board meetings and the Regional Corporation Board meetings here in Alyeska, down where we can get them away so that they would understand what corporate concept was. Now, it being the vehicle to receive land and monies, the issue of the Claims Act was land. And when you're able to start fighting for your land, you have to know how to define land. You begin very simply by asking a question: what is land to a farmer? Very simple. His time and labor on what he is able to plant and what he's able to get out of it. That's to a farmer. Then you get into the developer. It's what minerals he's able to extract from that land. So what I have to say about just those two elements tells you what land is all about. But it takes a person, the economist like Adam Smith, to tell you what land is. When he starts saying that land is the final source of all capital, we better understand that. That's why we wound up with the corporate concept, and we cannot separate the corporation from being responsible for the lands we hold in trust for our stockholders. not necessarily in trust, but we're the stewards to develop the corporation economically, but still maintain our ties with what we are, as Inupiat, myself, we have the Aleuts and Tlingits and Athabascans. I had to bring that out because we just cannot separate the land from the corporation. Being landlords, that's what we are. We're able to develop the lands to a very fair, and sometimes with the help of our stockholders in causing it to yield minerals, but properly. That's enough for now.
Mr. Borbidge?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. There are several items I'll touch on separately, the first of which is a very quick review of how the decisions were made in the Alaska Federation of Natives. As was indicated by a previous speaker, at one time the Alaska Federation of Natives had somewhere in the vicinity of 20 member organizations. As we came closer as a Native people to the settlement of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, there was a reorganization anticipating that there would be 12 regional corporations. The decision was made to reorganize AFN so that it would reflect a membership of 12 organizations. Prior to 1971, during the height of the lobbying activity, AFN, with a particular genius evolved by common consent by the people, on the one hand acted as one strong, powerful organization. This was done not only in response to a recognition by the Native people that there was a need to organize so that through unity we would have greater strength. But the fact was that Congress needed constant reassurance. They needed to view the Natives in the context that they could understand and that they could trust. They wanted a unified statewide organization. They wanted Native consensus or agreement. They wanted one proposal where possible to deal with. And this they received, not because they demanded it, but because the Native people themselves united for the first time in their history in Alaska. But the particular genius that reflected how the organization functioned was this. Given the complexity of a settlement, which comment I must preface by saying it was far, far more fun, easier, more enjoyable when we demanded a settlement and demanded justice, and we did. It was far harder to translate those demands for justice, which we asserted, into provisions in the legislation which had to be passed or, if it chose, rejected by the Congress. Not only, therefore, did we have to deal with this, but given the complexity of the ANCSA provisions as proposed by AFN, we made provision, which became a matter of board policy, AFN board policy, by which a regional association could make a proposal before the AFN board in order to have a regional proposal considered and made a part of let's say, a proposed AFN bill, that proposal coming from a regional association had to be voted as a matter of policy into the proposed bill by the AFN Board of Directors. If, however, the Board of Directors voted the provision down, the understanding was that the regional association could still go to Washington, D.C. and lobby as a separate entity, as a regional association, with the Congress and with the staff of the Congress to see if they could still prevail, notwithstanding their turndown at the AFN level. Joe Pixon was in Washington, D.C. when he was voted down on some provision before the AFN board, and when he was still representing the Arctic Slope Native Association. I also went to Washington, D.C. when a provision that I brought before the AFN board on behalf of the Central Council of the Tlingit and Haida Indians was voted down. Nevertheless, I prevailed on the point in Washington, D.C., and the provision still became law. The particular genius was the flexibility that was built into AFN so it could at one time reflect unity while still providing for basic and sometimes very fundamental and powerful differences as to what the Native organizations wanted to become part of the ANCSA law. I think it's important to note this very practical provision that AFN evolved, because I'm sure that the record that we have been making here should be viewed not only in terms of to the degree it will be beneficial to fellow Alaska Natives, but I also feel, as a matter of personal conviction, as I know others feel here, that we have an obligation to indigenous people in other parts of the world. What we've accomplished through ANCSA, however imperfect it is, and whatever may have been claimed for it, perfection has never been claimed, it still is a landmark. It is a point of departure. It is up to many of you who have testified now to take it on to the next step. But I hope that the record indicating how AFN managed to proceed in a very practical sense, accommodating these differences, will be recognized by some of the people coming in from other countries. I had mentioned earlier about the inclusion of the Tlingit and Haidas. The Tlingit and Haidas actually weren't brought in to AFN. We had to convince the board that we belonged. We also had to convince, and that was my function as president of the Central Council, I had to convince AFN, the State of Alaska, Department of Interior, the Alaska Congressional Delegation, the Congressional Committee, and the Congress. And the first one was AFN. We had some heated debates, and I understood perfectly the arguments of those who insisted that the Tlingit and Haidas had had a previous settlement. However, when it was pointed out by me that we also had unresolved claims in a very fundamentally important facet, judicially affirmed Indian title, the 2.6 million acres, which made it the strongest claims in the state, and we also had unresolved claims to the tidelands, this in effect was thrown into the pot, and to its eternal credit, AFN agreed that we should all proceed as one organization and have one statewide land claim. I want to illustrate in a better way, because I don't think that many people have illustrated their points better than Paul Tialana. And Martha, I like the way you have. And so I'll illustrate my point of how AFN functioned as one strong powerful entity while providing for the differences. As soon as I start, those of you who were there will know right away what I'm going to say, and you will too, Fran. There were many times in the AFN conventions when the discussions, the debates were heated. I mean, you read ANCSA now, and all you have is a sense, if you weren't there, that, oh, everybody agreed on this, everybody agreed on this provision. And it gives a reflection of one people hopping from provision A to B to C to D, and everybody agreeing all the way. We fought, and it was literally bare knuckles. We had to settle those differences, and we had heated debates, heated arguments, profoundly disturbing discussions in the AFN conventions, as well as on the board of directors. And just, I remember so vividly on several occasions, at a point when it appeared that the organization would be almost rent in two, if not three or four pieces, a man got up. He was one of our counselors. He was also an official of the Alaska Federation of Natives. He's Sergeant at Arms, Frank Dignan. And he put it far better than I could. He said something like this: "United we stand." And he folded his arms this way, look around. "Divided we still stand." And to me that was marvelous, and that really spelled it out. What he was saying is, we can be the separate tribal entities and to maintain that integrity. And we can still be one. It's possible to be both. And that's what Frank told us on several occasions. And he made us laugh when we badly, badly needed to be able to smile and to remember, hey, we are one people. I also want to share this observation. Corporation leaders, sometimes by force of law, but even more by acceptance of Western institutions, become much more than they mean to be, and sometimes become much more than they were intended to be. So when I make this observation, it is not in the spirit of saying, here is what corporation leaders have sought for themselves, but an observation of what they have been regarded as becoming. In a number of instances, corporate leaders have, generally speaking, been elected by corporate assets. Now, I'm not pointing a finger because I was president and chairman of the board of a corporation when that happened. And it happened thereafter, and it is happening now. It is just the nature of the corporation as it functions. And therefore, the corporation leaders using the assets in a perfectly legal way, of which I was a part, used TV and newspaper ads in urban areas. And in many instances, they do not have to stand directly before their people. Sometimes they even supplant leaders who are perhaps more highly regarded simply because governments, businesses, the media are impressed by economic strength and they're impressed by Western entities, corporations. Media and officials are more impressed by the things they understand than the things they don't understand. The corporation leaders then, not necessarily because they look for this, are then looked to for comments on matters known better by the traditional or tribal leaders and not by the corporation leaders, management, and directors. There's nothing that one can find in ANCSA that makes this something that was a provision in ANCSA, because it wasn't. And it is certainly something that is not particularly curable by the law. It is just an observation that I wish to share with you. I want to conclude with this observation, Mr. Chairman. The regional corporations are, as we have said on a number of occasions, business-for-profit corporations. They are also responsible for preserving the environment whenever there is a timber harvesting operation conducted by the corporation or its subsidiary. They're responsible for the environment, likewise, when there is a mining operation under their jurisdiction, directly or indirectly, and other types of operations. It would take a remarkably skillful concern corporation to be able to truly manage both effectively. I, for one, do not consider that it can be done by one entity, one corporation. Likewise, the corporations affect subsistence, hunting and fishing. Understandably, at the outset, with a consideration of first ANCSA and then ANILCA, the D2 legislation, the corporations had people who were experienced in obtaining the passage of laws and amendments to the laws. It is important that they take the front position in doing what they could, because things had to be done in a very short time to protect subsistence as quickly and as powerfully as possible. And by no means do I criticize that, having participated in that same event. However, there comes a point when it is important that the subsistence hunting and fishing concerns be affected more by the tribal entities or the nonprofit entities where there are no tribal entities functioning, because this is primarily their business. We have the situation in Southeast, not born of a desire to be at all deceitful or to maneuver, but it just happened. On our board, we had people concerned about subsistence, and we had commercial fishermen. And there, frankly, are some areas where you simply cannot reconcile the viewpoints of both. So I feel that subsistence must more and more be taken over. And I understand proposed legislation will affect the ANCSA corporations in any manner, shape, or form. The shareholders should be timely informed. In no wise should ANCSA corporations push through laws that affect the corporations or the people without the people knowing ahead of time. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Broadbridge. I think that I will just take a couple of minutes, first of all, to thank all of you who came to this first three-day session and to invite you to come tomorrow at 9 o'clock when Mr. Walter Parker will be giving a paper about the forms of land tenure and corporate institutions established under ANCSA and discussing the relationship of these corporations with the state and federal institutions, and discussing as well the possibilities for IRAs and other institutions that might evolve. You're all welcome to come tomorrow. Certainly the members of the panel have already been invited. Members of the public are invited. I can't assure you that we will have the same opportunity as we had today for members of the public to participate, but we will try to do that. I remind you that next week, on Tuesday, we will have Native leaders coming from the Lower 48, and we hope that all of you will feel free to come then to hear what they have to say about IRAs, about land, about the way in which they manage their affairs. And on the following Tuesday, we will have Native leaders and scholars coming from Canada and Greenland, Norway and Australia to talk about how they have grappled with these issues in their own countries. And you're all invited to come and hear those people. I can't guarantee that we will have audience participation, because when we bring people from far away, we want to, so to speak, get the maximum mileage out of them. But we'll try to work things out as we have today. Now, may I just say that I do appreciate the contributions that all have made. It seems clear that there are some very serious questions about ANCSA that you wish to raise relating to shares, taxation, particularly, and it has been brought up a number of times, the failure to include natives born since 1971 in the settlement, except as heirs. We ran into that same question in Amonik and Tununuk, and in Amonik, one of the teachers at the school pointed out that of something like 211 students in the schools in Amonik, the elementary school and the high school, 109 were shareholders under ANCSA and 102 were not. It was a graphic illustration of the division of these young people under ANCSA. You've made the point, many of you, that sovereignty was not addressed by ANCSA. Others have made the point that water rights were not addressed. Many of you have urged that consideration be given to the use of IRAs here in Alaska, that is, greater use than has been made of them thus far. And we expect that those coming from the lower 48 next week, starting on Tuesday, will be able to tell us a lot about how IRAs have worked out in the lower 48, because I repeat what I said before, it seems to me that Mr. Byron Malott put it well when he said, I don't want to exchange one set of problems for another set. Let's find out a little more about IRAs. Let's find out a lot more about IRAs and see what the possibilities may be there. Now, may I just make one suggestion to you, that the world is an imperfect place. It was in 1971 when many of those around this table worked to obtain the very best deal they could for Alaska Natives. And it has in 12 years served to hold and consolidate 44 million acres of Native ancestral lands. It has provided the means for the disposition in one way or another of 962.5 million dollars. And it has given economic influence, and I think growing out of that, political influence to Alaska Natives that they never had before. Mr. Starr said that Native people should be acknowledged to be owners of subsurface rights. Well, ANCSA is a unique settlement with Native peoples in that it does acknowledge their right to subsurface rights. Those rights are held by regional corporations, but still, Congress acknowledged that subsurface rights should be included in the settlement. In Greenland, for instance, they have home rule for the Inuit majority there, but they haven't settled their land claims. Denmark hasn't yet been prepared to give up subsurface rights in Greenland. There are a number of legal and constitutional questions that arise here, and that's why we have David Case here as our legal and constitutional advisor. But it seems to me that what you've all said, and those who've participated from the audience have said, indicates that beneath these surface waters, there are some strong currents beneath the surface. And we should know more about those currents so that we can chart a direction for the future. And that's why these meetings, I hope, are going to be as useful during the next 2.5 weeks as these first 3 days have been. And that's why, after these meetings are over, we are going to go to the villages again for the remainder of the year to visit as many as we can to see what the people living there have to say. Because only then will we really be in a position to plumb the depth of these waters. I should say for those in the audience who live in Anchorage that we intend to hold a village meeting in Anchorage if the mayor and city council will allow me to describe Anchorage as a village for purposes of our commission, so that native people living here in Anchorage can participate in the work of the commission. I think that these 3 days are instructive and creative, and I know that that you think maybe I'm being a bit of an old nanny when I say that I don't want us to engage in name-calling with each other or with others not present. I don't think that will get us anywhere, and I think it has really been a most constructive and creative 3 days. So we really must give up the hall because they're about ready to assemble the bingo table, and so I'll adjourn till 9 a.m. and thank you again.